But it's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Professor Tom Dukes, who's also a colonel with the Virginia National Guard. He's the director of the strategic initiatives for the Virginia National Guard, as well as an adjunct professor of cyber law and policy at the University of Virginia and at the University of Tartu, Estonia. He previously served in the U.S. Department's Deputy Coordinator for Cyber Issues, as a senior trial lawyer for the U.S. Justice Department Computers Crime and Intellectual Property Sections, and as an active duty U.S. Air Force Judge Advocate. He earned his J.D. degree from the University of Virginia School of Law and the B.A. from the University of Maine at Farmington. Please welcome Colonel Professor Tom Dukes. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Rich, and to the senior statesman of Virginia for inviting me to spend a bit of time with you this afternoon and talk about the issue of cybersecurity, particularly when the weather outside is so nice. This is definitely one of the nicest days we've had and gives me hope both for UVA prevailing in the ACC basketball tournament this weekend and beyond, and also that spring is maybe finally here to stay. So what I'm going to do today, instead of what I often see as kind of the standard cybersecurity presentation, is here are all the horrible things that are happening to us that could happen to you. Be very afraid. Hide under a rock. There's nothing you do to save yourself. I'm not going to take that approach with you. What I'm going to do instead is come at this at a hopefully fairly strategic level and talk to you about sort of the big picture view of how to think about all these various related issues that we cluster under the topic of cybersecurity, and give you some perspective in terms of what the federal government is doing to address these issues, what the state of the law and policy is here in the United States, what the global debate looks like in terms of how our friends, our adversaries, and our frenemies think about these issues, and then finish up with a little bit about what the Commonwealth of Virginia at the state level is doing to tackle cybersecurity needs. So hopefully we'll be able to hit this at the right level. I basically took the three-hour undergraduate cyber policy class that I teach at UVA at the Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy and boiled it down to about 60 minutes. So you'll all be eligible for, I guess, 3 credits of college credit at the end of this. But so here's kind of the outline that we're going to go through. Again, I'm certainly looking forward to your questions at the end. And so without further ado, let's dive right in. So in preparing for this, I was asked to give a few kind of teasers, short headlines that could help capture the things I'm going to talk about and get you thinking. So this is how I'm going to basically break down the talk. I talk to you a little bit about what cybersecurity is, what are the key threats and the key actors that we should be thinking about. Then talk to you, the bulk of this will be talking to you about the legal and policy framework here in the United States, again, at a fairly high level, with a focus on the federal government and then also the state government. And I'll say up front, as I always prominently put on the syllabus for any of the classes I teach, there is no requirement for any type of technical knowledge or cyber or computer knowledge to be able to understand this. It really, if you're an inquisitive, intellectually curious person who wants to understand how the world operates and understand kind of the big debates that are going on, then you should have no problem following along. So just to sort of orient us a bit, today the global population is about 7.7 billion people. And of that number, roughly half have some access to the internet. And by some access to the internet, that could be anything from the really high-speed internet connectivity that in theory you can get in a place like Charlottesville, to someone who is using a cell phone over a very sort of low bandwidth cellular network to be able to have the most basic kind of maybe text messaging. So we're capturing everybody. And if you look at how this is distributed around the globe, if you're in the United States or Europe, you're doing pretty well. You know, roughly 80% of the population or greater have access to the internet. If you're in sub-Saharan Africa, then, you know, it's around 30%. In Asia, the number is less than 50%, and, you know, that's factoring in the billion-plus people in China, the same number in India, as well as countries like Korea and Japan, which have higher internet connectivity than we do. So the key takeaway here is that access to the internet is very unequally distributed around the globe, and that the wealthy countries, the northern hemisphere primarily, are the ones that have the connectivity. Cybersecurity threats. Again, lots and lots of very technical things. I'm sure that if you read the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, listen to the news, I would say that on most days, there is going to be some story probably on the front page about something bad happening in connection with cyberspace and the internet. But what I pulled for you to, again, kind of frame our discussion here are three of the top line observations from the U.S. Intelligence community's worldwide threat assessment that the Director of National Intelligence, Coates, provided to Congress back in January. And if you look at the report, it covers, you know, every threat, including climate change, that I guess you'll be hearing about at your next meeting. But cyber is front and center, and the number one thing that was highlighted by the Director of National Intelligence that keeps him awake at night. And really, the primary focus was looking at what our adversaries, principally Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, are doing and are capable of doing, using the internet, cyber capabilities to influence everything from military to political to economic aspects of the U.S. and our allies, of our countries and our economies and our national security. The report, secondly, highlighted the continued and increasing threat from cybercrime. And by this, what I'm really talking about are large-scale attacks against banks, the theft of intellectual property, very large dollar number kinds of activities that are either carried out by extremely well-organized transnational criminal groups that typically model themselves on the traditional mafia, going so far as, in my experience as a cybercrime prosecutor, to always want to have, you know, a godfather and capos and made men, and they really have clearly always taken their cue from the Godfather and Goodfellas in terms of putting together their criminal activities. But also countries like North Korea are heavily involved in using the internet to engage in all sorts of bank fraud other types of activities that generate revenues for the regime. And then the other main area actually was broken out as a separate, the number two topic that was highlighted in the threat assessment is the threat that is posed to election processes here in the United States, but also in other democratic countries, by countries that are looking to use the internet, to use social media platforms and the like, to be able to disrupt elections, but also to engage in behavior that would generally undermine the openness and take advantage of and undermine our open democratic institutions. So those are kind of the big picture strategic threats that, again, if you ask at the very top strategic level, the military, the Department of Defense, identifies roughly the same threats as does the national security strategy that was issued by the president in 2017. So one of the things that I find really interesting and also encouraging about the issues I'm going to talk to you about today is that cybersecurity is really a bipartisan issue. So what I put up here is in In May of 2011, President Obama issued a U.S. international strategy for cyberspace. It was the first time any country had put together a strategy focused on cyberspace, the internet. It was then followed by, you know, at this point, probably, you know, the 50 largest economies in the world have all issued similar strategies that lay out at ideally a strategic level how they view the internet, the good, the bad, where they want things to go, what they want the world to look like. These seven the top line strategic objective for the United States in cyberspace is to have, was, as President Obama explained it, an internet cyberspace that's open, interoperable, secure, and reliable. When President Trump issued an executive order that I'll talk about a little bit later in early 2018 to lay out his administration's strategic vision for the internet, he called for a cyberspace that is open, interoperable, reliable, and secure. So secure and reliable were reversed, but the substance was exactly the same. And in Congress, this is a highly bipartisan issue. Again, it's not like there's a Republican position on cyberspace issues and a Democratic position. There's essentially a position that the government, both at the executive and the congressional level, has largely agreed upon. And the International Strategy for Cyberspace basically broke out the sort of the policy areas into seven distinct areas. I'm going to talk about most of them in the slides that follow. In terms of definitions, it's always good to make sure that we're all on the same page. So three key terms to keep in mind that I'll be using throughout the presentation. So the internet. The internet is essentially the network of networks, all the connected infrastructure that allows us to get online, to do everything we do over the internet, to do everything we do over mobile and cellular networks and the like. So it's the infrastructure and the related hardware, software, and computer protocols and the like that make the internet do the things that we want it to do for us. Cyberspace is taking the internet and then adding in the humans, the people who use the internet, and then all the data and information that they generate, that they store, that they move around. So when we talk about cyberspace, it's more than just the infrastructure. It's the infrastructure plus the users plus what they're doing online. And then cybersecurity is often used as a pretty broad umbrella term to capture pretty much anything to do with cyberspace, the internet, you name it, whether we're talking about protecting and defending the actual infrastructure or issues of cybercrime or free speech online, you name it. But in its most pure sense, cybersecurity is focused on essentially securing the infrastructure and what people do with that infrastructure from all sorts of threats and making sure that it's available even in a degraded capacity when we need to use it. So protecting us, protecting our data, protecting the infrastructure. So the first big area I'm going to talk about is cybersecurity focused on the aspects of protecting our critical infrastructure. So as with any big, you know, important issue, there have been a number of commissions that have been convened by the White House, by Congress over the last 5-6 years to look at different aspects of cybersecurity. And one of the most comprehensive was done in 2015 and 2016 at the tail end of the Obama administration to essentially take a big picture look at cyber issues and technology in the United States and try to identify what were the key things that needed to be focused on in the decades ahead. What are some of the trends that we're seeing? And then, you know, what are kind of the most important things that have to be done at the government level, at the individual user level, at the business level? And so as you can see, you know, pretty much anything that you would think of in terms of cybersecurity or emerging technologies, so everything from, you know, looking at the Internet of Things to autonomous vehicles, to how do we measure cybersecurity, privacy and trust, so what do entities like Facebook do with the information that we post. Well, I don't actually use Facebook, but for those of you who use Facebook, what does it do with the information you post online? What's the role of free markets versus regulatory regimes? You know, so what should the government do? What should the market do to deal with cybersecurity? And the two key things that the commission, and this was a Blue Ribbon Commission co-chaired by Sam Palmasino, former CEO of IBM, and a number of real heavyweights from industry and also government. Their two key takeaways were that to have effective cybersecurity, you're going to have really good partnership and cooperation between the government and between industry. And secondly, that when we think about how do we protect against cybersecurity threats, there is no way to completely stop bad things from happening over the internet, unless, of course, you just completely disconnect and don't use it. So the focus really has to be on how do we use a risk management approach. So understanding, if you're a company, you know, what your exposure is, what kinds of networks you're running, how you're connected to the internet, how people are able to log in and authenticate themselves on your networks, who has access to what, but then also understanding and managing your risks appropriately. Again, understanding that you can't protect against all threats. And then secondly, looking at the issue of resilience. And this is the idea that you're going to be, if you're a business, if you're the government, hopefully not if you know this wouldn't apply so much at the individual level, but you're going to be subject to cyber attacks and cyber, bad things are going to happen to you. And what you need to do is to make sure that your systems can continue to operate, that you have the resilience to continue the bank can continue to run, it can continue to process transactions, it can keep its websites up, even in the face of cyber attacks. So they recommended quite a few things, focused around, educating and preparing people, building workforce capabilities. In Virginia alone, the number changes, but right now there are roughly 50,000 unfilled cybersecurity jobs in Virginia. 50,000 in Virginia. And these are jobs that typically have starting salaries of, $75,000 or higher. So huge workforce capabilities, workforce challenges. The government can't recruit and keep people in this area. Companies have a very hard time maintaining their workforce. It's one of the reasons you see so much of a focus on things like artificial intelligence and machine learning to find ways to automate as many aspects as possible of protecting against cybersecurity threats. But again, that there will continue to be lots of innovation and the like, but that, again, if you look at the bottom one, that as things develop in the United States, at least, we want to try to ensure that they happen in a way that's consistent with, openness, fairness, free market competition, and security. Security both for ourselves and for our allies. Because as you'll see as we go through the presentation, if you think about cybersecurity, it's not something that you can really accomplish effectively at just the national level. So there's not much that we can certainly in the United States try to have higher standards, protect against as many threats as we can. But if there's not a baseline level of cybersecurity hygiene across the globe, then we'll just be subject to endless attacks and threats from outside the United States. Everything about the internet today is globally connected. And, something that's done by a country, a few years ago, Turkey decided that they wanted to stop certain videos that were being posted on YouTube. So what they decided to do was to block the ability of anyone in Turkey to access YouTube by pointing them to something that would just basically send their traffic, their request into a black hole. But they did it in a way that I'll talk about a little bit later when we discuss internet governance that made everybody on the entire globe who was trying to access YouTube have the same result, and they basically couldn't get to YouTube. So the ripple effects of trying to do something and isolate it are often pretty significant. Okay, so again, if you think about cybersecurity and you think about sort of what has been done by the U.S. government to address this topic, it really, really is a recent area of focus. The George W. Bush administration was really the first time that we saw the executive branch try to get its arms around cyber issues in a fairly comprehensive way. And President Bush started a number of efforts. Richard Clark, who was his Homeland Security advisor, was behind honchoing a lot of this. But it was really, you know, only about a decade ago that the president and the executive branch said, cyber issues are something we really need to care about. Cybersecurity is something we need to start focusing on as a cross-cutting issue of national strategic importance. And then really the Obama administration was when we started to see a lot of robust activity coming out of the White House around the issue of cybersecurity. But still, again, you know, very much in its infancy. So as I said, in May 2011, the U.S. prepared and put together the first strategy that we had ever done or anyone had ever done at a national level around cyberspace. A few years after that, and President Obama issued about 10 different executive orders related to cybersecurity. I'm not going to mention all of them. But one of the key ones was he directed the Commerce Department's National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, to work in partnership with industry and develop a framework that could be used by private sector companies, universities, the government in the United States, globally, but to create a framework that any organization that wanted to be able to understand cybersecurity in the context of their individual organization, to give them a framework that they could use to do that. And so the NIST cybersecurity framework was created. It's gone through several different updates in the last couple of years, but it gives an organization an ability to catalog what they have, to look at and identify the risks they face, and then to make conscious decisions about how much risk they want to take and where they want to expend their resources. So not to say everybody needs to get to 100% gold standard perfect approach to cybersecurity, but to allow entities, particularly private sector entities, to be able to identify the risks they face and decide what level of risk they want to take. Now, their insurance companies and their stockholders may have different ideas about what's an appropriate level of risk, but it at least gives you a framework that can be used anywhere globally to tackle that. Then, towards the tail end of the Obama administration, one of the big dialogues that kept taking place among officials from the administration and industry, and we're talking big banks, but also the Apples and the Googles of the world, the, you know, the Fords and GMs of the world, was to say, hey, U.S. government, we know you're doing a lot around cybersecurity, but it's very disorganized. It's impossible to know who to go to if I've been hit by, you know, so if I'm a bank and I've been hacked and had a bunch of information on from my customers stolen, who do I go to? Do I go to my local police? Do I call the FBI? Do I call the Secret Service? Do I call the Department of Homeland Security? Do I call the National Security Agency? And so one of the recurring issues was that from outside the government, there was not any kind of clear understanding, and it was because it wasn't clear at all to anybody outside of the government, often to those of us inside the government, how the U.S. federal government was structured to deal with cyber threats, and when you called them, and when they would come and help you. So a presidential policy directive was created. So unlike an executive order that says, executive branch, you will go do the following, presidential policy directive is essentially it's a statement of administration policy designed to inform the U.S., our partners around the globe, as to how we think about a certain issue. Same thing with the strategy. And so Presidential Policy Directive 41 was written, and it said, okay, if you have these types of events, then the FBI is in the lead. If you have this type of event, the Department of Homeland Security is in the lead. This is when, you know, the military or the intelligence community might get involved. But it also made clear that the government, the federal government, was not going to be able to respond to every single thing that happened in terms of a cybersecurity incident. So it set a threshold and said that only significant cyber incidents would trigger a federal government response. And significant is basically tied to threats that affect our national security, our national economic interests, our allies, and the like. So a pretty broad yet clearly high-level standard for when the federal government, when a bank should call the federal government as opposed to when they should go to the companies that they pay to provide them with internet security and ask them to help fix something. And then in May of 2017, the Trump administration put out an executive order that is titled Strengthening Cybersecurity of Federal Networks and Critical Infrastructure, but it's really the sort of the grand strategic view with a lot of down in the weeds operational stuff too, but essentially the strategic view of how the Trump administration views cybersecurity. And again, that is where instead of saying the U.S. advocates an open, interoperable, secure, and reliable internet, they said we advocate for an open, interoperable, reliable, and secure internet. And essentially restated and adopted specifically basically every single executive order and policy directive. So, for instance, policy directive, Presidential Policy Directive 41, the NIST cybersecurity framework, all of that was explicitly adopted by the Trump administration. It's almost quite literally the only area I can think of where the Trump administration has embraced, adopted, not changed, not rejected major guidance that was put in place by the Obama administration. So again, I emphasize that just to make the point that this really is an area where there's not a lot of ground, even if you want to have partisan disagreements, political disagreements, there's really not much room to have those around issues like cybersecurity. Okay, so cybercrime, and again, the big picture goal here is to give you a framework just to think about these issues. It's not to make you an expert on any of this stuff. I spent almost a decade as a cybercrime investigator for the Justice Department, mostly going after Russian and Ukrainian organized crime groups that got into cyber, doing a lot of sort of big global messy cases, but also dealing with people like the systems administrator for the organ donation center that covered Houston and South Texas, who was fired, and because she was unhappy with being fired, went in and destroyed all the databases of information for essentially all the organ donation records for South Texas. Now, thankfully, there was a backup system that she tried to connect to and also wipe out, but was not able. The connection was basically, they were having problems, so the connection was down, so she wasn't able to get in and wipe up the backups, so thankfully they could restore, but you also see that sort of crime. So when you hear the idea of cybercrime, it kind of has two different meanings. One is these crimes that can only be committed using or affecting computers, so hacking into a bank's online databases and stealing the information, or healthcare providers, or stealing intellectual property. So, most companies have that develop and work with intellectual property, so trade secrets, technical information, designs for next generation, systems, confidential business information. Almost everybody has that information stored on their computer networks. Not always. Some old school, situations are Coke still keeps, the secret formula for Coke locked in a safe in their headquarters in Atlanta. Sometimes it's a mixture, right? I prosecuted a case in Richmond involving a Korean company that stole the manufacturing process for Kevlar from DuPont. using a variety of old school kind of corporate espionage techniques and online activities. But you know, in that case, DuPont then sued the company for $1 billion, won the case in Richmond, and then after that happened, the Justice Department swooped in with criminal indictments against the Korean officials who had done that. But intellectual property theft is a major, major issue. And when you look at how it's framed in terms of the threat from China, that's generally called out as probably the most serious aspect of what China is doing to cause harm to the United States. It's the large-scale concerted efforts to steal, whether it's military technology, solar power technology, you name it. But the theft of intellectual property is a huge, huge issue, particularly for countries like the United States, but also Germany, Japan, all sort of advanced industrial countries. And then the other type of cybercrime is basically committing any other type of crime, but doing it over the internet. So the person who plots to kill their spouse and does internet searches, you know, looking for, you know, what's the best way to poison somebody over time so you can't tell. Pretty much nowadays, it's hard to find any type of criminal activity that doesn't involve evidence that's found on a cell phone or posted on Facebook or live streamed somewhere. So pretty much all crime has become cybercrime these days. The key to thinking about how do you effectively deal with modern high-tech crime is you have to think of it in terms of a global issue. So if the United States says it's a crime to hack, but Russia doesn't, and individuals in Russia hack into, you know, banks in the United States, and then we go to Russia and say, hey, we identified some criminals in your country who hacked into our bank. If Russia says, well, that's not a crime in Russia, then that's pretty much the end of the discussion, unless and until those individuals decide that, you know, it's been a long winter in Moscow and they really want to go to the beach in Spain or Thailand or someplace like that, which happens surprisingly frequently, even for people who know that they're under criminal indictment. Crazy. But you have to think of it, you know, so how do you create a global approach to cybercrime in the same way we've done with drug trafficking, with human trafficking, with you know, large-scale financial fraud. And so you have to make sure you have the right things criminalized, that everyone agrees that hacking into a bank is a crime. You have to make sure that law enforcement has the right capabilities and authorities to go out and investigate and gather the evidence and share it. And then you have to make sure that you have a framework for allowing countries to cooperate and share information. So again, when I was a cybercrime prosecutor at the Justice Department, very few of the cases we worked on were just United States. We almost always had to go and get cooperation from foreign partners. And likewise, you know, a crime that was being investigated in the Netherlands that involved hacking would almost always, you know, have some evidence that was located in the United States. So you have to have a way to share that information. The primary way that the U.S. Tries to do that, and what we promote is the Budapest Cybercrime Convention, which is a Council of Europe treaty that was launched in November of 2001. It's got about 65, 70 countries that are party to it. So basically everybody in Europe, plus the U.S., Canada, Australia, Japan, Korea, about five or six countries in Africa, quite a few countries in Central and South America. But it is the global framework for what countries need to do to tackle cybercrime. This is a little bit, you know, cybercrime geeky, but if you want to just kind of, you know, think about for a minute, if you were investigating a crime that involved, you know, information that was on the internet or a cell phone or the like, there are basically four types of scenarios that you can deal with. One is you're going after information that's stored. So it's something's already happened. There's a photo, a video, an email, a text message, and you're trying to get that information. The other scenario is you're intercepting, getting information in real time. So you're doing like what you think of as a wiretap. You're listening in on somebody's communications online. You're catching their internet activity as it happens. And then you can take the information that you would get or need to get and break it into basically two categories. One would be content, so the actual content of an email, the actual picture itself. And then the other aspect would be non-content. So this might be the email address of the person you sent the email to, but not the actual substance of the email itself. Or the IP address, the internet protocol address that was used to hack into the bank. So again, we won't dwell on that too much, but it's just a framework to think about these things. Okay, this is probably the most interesting and meaty of the issues. And so I'll spend a little bit more time talking about internet governance than some of the previous things. So what is internet governance? Again, it's a term that often gets used as a big kind of blanket umbrella thing to capture all sorts of stuff. But it's basically the technical and policy underpinnings of how the internet works, how cyberspace works. So I won't spend too much time talking about these things on this slide. We'll get into them as we move on. But the big global debate around this idea of internet governance is whether it should be a multi-stakeholder or a multilateral issue. And so multi-stakeholder means everybody who has skin in the game or dog in the fight gets to have a say in how the internet and how it works evolves. And that's the traditional model that has allowed the internet to grow to what it is today, meaning governments have a say, but university academics that are doing all the R&D have a say, the companies that are developing and selling the technologies have a say, individual users, non-governmental organizations and the like all have a say, and you take everybody's interest into account. That's the view that the US, the Europeans, the Japanese, the Australians, Canadians strongly support. It's, again, what got us to where we are today. The competing view is the idea of multilateralism, meaning that only governments should have a say in these kinds of decisions. And this is the view that's espoused by Russia and China and Iran and Saudi Arabia and most of the developing world, which view so many aspects of the internet. So we go back to that slide where I showed you that if you're in North America, Europe, then life is pretty good. Almost everybody has high-speed internet connectivity of some type. If you're in the rest of the world, not so much. If you look at where almost all the big technology companies are from, you think about issues like this debate over whether the U.S. should allow Huawei to sell hardware that we would use in our networks in the United States. Most of the rest of the world says the U.S. created the system. The U.S. and its friends benefit greatly from this, and they don't want anything to change because that would upset the longstanding baked-in advantages for the United States. And so the multilateral argument is these issues really need to be cited in the United Nations, where only countries vote, and let's have a vote about it in the UN. And when you have a vote about things in the UN, as I'll get to in a minute, and you run the numbers, the U.S. will almost never win on an issue that lines it up against the rest of particularly the developing world. So let's see. I'm going to skip over that. This is my slide. Well, this is an actual chalkboard. They still have these at the law school. It's crazy. I actually usually ask for a classroom that has a chalkboard, as opposed to now they're replacing them with those whiteboards with markers. Not nearly as much fun as breaking chalk and doing all this. But okay, so I'm going to give you in about 2 minutes the history of the internet and how we got from where we our very sort of earliest days to now. You may know a lot of this, but I think it's helpful just to hear for the first time or have as a refresher. So back around the time of the Civil War, there was an organization created called the International Telegraph Union. It eventually, over time, was rebranded as the International Telecommunication Union, became part of the United Nations, and is in Geneva, in a really nice building overlooking Lake Geneva. That is the place within the United Nations where all telecom issues generally come home to roost. Okay, so 1960s, 70s, you have the Defense Department sponsoring the development of the beginning of the internet. So ARPA, which became DARPA, so basically the DoD research and development folks, funding a work that was done at Stanford and USC and UCLA largely. You had the development of the computer microprocessors, the creation of Microsoft and Apple as kind of the first technology companies. That's happening in the late 60s into the 70s. Into the 1980s is when you start to see the internet turning into a thing. So going from the initial four universities that were connected at the very beginning to starting to spread across academia, the government, even the private sector. And you see the creation of things like TCP/IP, which is one of the primary basically computer protocols or computer sort of communication standards that allows you to make a connection and share information across the internet. So that happens in the 1980s. The 1990s. So, you know, Al Gore has gotten grief over the years for his claim that he created the internet. Well, you know, it's not entirely fair he probably overstated it, or at least the way he stated it made it sound like perhaps he did more than he should get credit for. But he was the sponsor when he was in the Senate of the legislation that essentially took the maintenance of the internet and basically said, okay, this internet thing has now gotten big enough that it shouldn't be some university folks that have been helping run it for decades along with the Commerce Department and a little bit of DOD. That should not be who runs the internet, and that if government continues to try to manage the internet, then it's not going to grow very fast or very efficiently. We need to push it out of government and have commerce still basically manage this, but hand it off and let this really innovate and grow fast. So that legislation led to the creation in the late 90s of an organization called ICANN, which was essentially created by the Commerce Department as an external nonprofit, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, and its job was to manage the key functions of the internet, to decide who could get IP addresses, which are essentially phone numbers that need to be distributed for, you know, everything that's connected to the internet needs to have a phone number. And so that function was handed out, deciding who can register which domains, so who gets to be a .gov, a .edu, a .com, a .org, distributing all that information, and then also maintaining sort of the phone book for the internet and everything connected to it, so you know where to go to find a particular site, like the University of Virginia website. All that was given to ICANN under a contract called the IANA contract, the Internet Assigned Names and Numbers contract. And then you fast forward into the 2000s, and this is where the rest of the global community really starts to wake up to the internet as a thing that has significant implications for the future of the economies, you know, quality of life, security, et cetera. And so the UN starts to do things to stake out a claim to helping shape the future of the internet and cyberspace. And so there's a thing called the World Symposium on the Information Society that was convened by the UN, held in Tunis, Tunisia. And that was where basically the global community through the UN said, yes, the UN really should be helping decide these global issues, so many of them around the future of the internet. And that led to the creation of a number of other UN-focused processes. Also, again, just for perspective, you know, so less than 15 years ago is when we see the creation of the iPhone, of the Android phone, of things like Facebook. I mean, a lot of these innovations, even the iPhone, is barely a decade old. And then as we move into the last decade, you start to see all sorts of things happen to expand the scope of the internet, to allow to go from the traditional 7 or 8 top-level domains that you could use to hundreds, which led to all sorts of interesting political and other battles. So, for instance, when ICANN started to auction off, have auctions, if you wanted to, say, .Amazon. So Amazon, the company, said, you know, we want to basically be able to get .Amazon, so instead of .com, .Amazon, as a top-level domain that we would be able to control. So they put in an application for that, you know, paid the whatever it is, the $250,000 fee. And then a certain country in South America jumped in and said, wait a second, we have a claim to the Amazon. So Brazil said, hey, you can't do this. Same thing happened with France and efforts to register .vin, V-I-N, or, you know, all sorts of things that you know, the commercial sector said, you know, that has meaning for us, but individual countries or regions said, you know, no, that's something that belongs to us. You can't try to make that into a commercial thing. Then we also had a number of incidents like the Snowden revelations that really, I mean, so I was at the State Department as the number two cyber policy official when the Snowden leaks came out. And, you know, the pretty good relationships and good progress we were making with, you name it, Germany, India, just about everybody who wasn't the U.S. Or our Five Eyes partners, who never got any of the grief that got some of the grief, but like, you know, the U.S. got all the grief, but our partners in doing this kind of signals intelligence stuff largely were able to hide behind us. But the Snowden revelations really, really upset the political, you know, scene around these issues and really put the U.S. In a much more challenging position trying to be the leader on these issues. So what you saw instead was efforts like NetMundial, which was the Brazilian government along with the Swedish government and the Germans and some others saying, well, we're going to try to come up with, you know, basically saying, well, these discussions in the UN are interesting, but too complicated to get anything decided because there's so many voices. U.S. can't really be trusted. So Brazil, Germany, Sweden said, hey, we'll start our own little group and we'll try to solve these issues and decide who should run the internet. So they did that. Also about that time, so this is around 2012, 2013, it was time for the ITU, so our International Telegraph Union that had become the International Telecommunication Union, to update its constitution in the UN, which they hadn't done for about 25 years. And so there was an effort at that constitutional update event to put a lot of things into the Constitution that would have then been controlling across the UN to say, the UN will make these decisions about running the internet. We'll take over the responsibilities from ICANN and others. You know, it ended up being a big fight between the US and our allies, the US, Europe, Japan, versus Russia, China, and the others. The objectionable provisions were put into the Constitution. When it came time to vote on this, and this is, again, a continuation of the Constitution of basically the rules of the road for how countries communicate with each other. So, you know, originally, what are the standards, the technical standards for having telegraph communications across borders? Then is with the rise of telecommunications, phones, how do you make sure that a phone call that's placed in the United States can actually reach the person you're trying to call in Mexico? The technical standards, the billing standards, everything related to making all that happen, that's all in the purview of the ITU. The ITU has also said we should be doing this for the internet. So this comes up for a vote. The U.S., our European allies, the Australian, Japanese, Canadians, a few other key countries like Kenya, a number of South American countries, all vote no on this treaty. And things have basically stood like that now for over 5 years, where this new treaty is just kind of sitting there, and no one knows what the real state of play is anymore because so many of the key global, you know, players voted not to adopt this new treaty. So more to be seen. Then what happened was the Commerce Department realizing, we're really not in a good place in terms of trying to, the U.S. is still managing running the internet, all the key functions through this contract, this sole source contract that the Commerce Department has with ICANN, which includes, among other things, managing all of the internet's DNS root directories. So DNS is called Domain Name Service. It's basically the phone book. So if you type in, you want to go look at, the Daily Progress website, you type in, dailyprogress.com. You don't type in the long string of numbers like here on the third bullet. If you want to go to Virginia, the University of Virginia website, you type in virginia.edu. You don't type in 128.143.33.150. If you did type that in, it would take you to the Virginia website. And so that's how locations are set around the internet. Now, somebody has to keep track of all that because, your computer by itself, your web browser doesn't know, what that number, how it corresponds to Virginia. So the domain name system is essentially the phone book for everything on the internet that allows you to find specific computers and websites and the like. That is one of the things that ICANN ran for years. And there were 13 computers that were responsible for managing that phone directory. And then they redistribute the information to hundreds more around the globe. But right now, those 13 primary phone directories for the internet are located, 10 of them are in the United States, one is in Sweden, one is in the Netherlands, and one is in Japan. And the people that set that update the phone book and keep it current and all that is VeriSign, which is up in Northern Virginia. And so the United States has essentially complete control over deciding how traffic gets routed around the internet. And a lot of other countries don't like that. And so the Commerce Department announced almost 5 years ago that they were going to come up with a plan for handing off some of the functions, including letting another country have one of the 13 or maybe create a 14th central phone directory for the internet. Hasn't happened yet. So for whatever reason. I'm going to skip over a couple of things. Okay, so big data and privacy. So the thing that's important to note here is that in the 2017 National Security Strategy, it's the first time that a strategic document like that mentioned data as a thing. And basically, this is consistent with the idea that you hear frequently that data is the new oil or the new energy. But it's this recognition that the U.S. now says that among all the other big things we have to worry about and the resources we have to track, data is high on that list. And so one of the things that also happened during the Obama administration was this thing called the Big Data Report that was done to look at how private entities use your data, so how the Facebooks and Googles of the world use your data. It was done by John Podesta, led it. Shockingly, I won't make any kind of inference here, but the whole initiative to do this started very soon after the Snowden revelations, when everyone was pointing at how government was using data. This was an effort to make sure that people understood that in addition to government doing things with data, the private sector also does a lot with data that you should care about. Oops, what did I do? Okay. So it made lots of recommendations that shouldn't surprise you, that we need to educate people, we need to promote privacy, we need to make sure that law enforcement and national security can access data when it needs to, that we need to start viewing data as a public resource like utility or other resources that can be leveraged. Privacy in the United States. So the Fourth Amendment recognizes a right to privacy against unreasonable search and seizure of your home or your personal effects by the government. But the U.S. doesn't have any kind of broad, comprehensive privacy law or laws that address privacy broadly, particularly against the private sector. We have a patchwork of things covering what financial institutions do with your information and data, what happens with health information, what happens with educational information. But we don't have any kind of comprehensive privacy law here in the United States. So the European Union has a very comprehensive approach to privacy, which they significantly updated last year and are aggressively pushing as the global standard for how to think about these issues. And, you know, I have to say, on balance, pretty much everything they advocate for makes a lot of sense. Whether or not, you know, we in the U.S. want the European Union to be the one setting the global standard and enforcing this is another matter. But there's a lot of very useful things. So, for instance, the European Union says if you're a company, no matter where you're located, but you're using data from European citizens, you've got European customers who are trying to buy something from your website, then you're going to be subject to their rules on protecting privacy. They put in place, you know, fines of up to 4% of a company's global revenue if they violate it. You think about a company like Google that made, you know, $60 billion in global revenue last year. And that adds up very quickly. Also, this idea that really that you as an individual should have a very high degree of control and ownership over your data and information. So it created a number of rights, you know, if there's a data breach. So this was one of the things that Congress has grappled with for years, but not been able to come up with a U.S. federal standard for how to deal with data breaches. So the bank gets hacked, your information gets stolen. There's no federal law that says to the bank, this is when they have to tell you, this is what they have to do for you. Every state in the U.S. has passed its own law, so there's a patchwork of laws. In Virginia, we actually have a great law. It says that if even one person has their data stolen, then the company has to, or the entity has to tell you. There are provisions in all state laws that allow, you know, for some delay if there's an ongoing criminal investigation and the like. But you contrast that with California, where unless you get to about 1,000 people that are affected, companies, institutions don't have much of a responsibility to report it. Companies hate this because they have to figure out how to comply with, you know, 50 different rules here in the U.S. Again, the EU is trying to set a global standard here. They also have a bunch of things that basically say you own your data, so you should be able to see what a company has on you at any time, what they're doing with it. You should be able to take that data with you. You should be able to, so if you want to leave Facebook and go to whatever becomes the next Facebook, you should be able to take your data. Facebook gives it to you and you move it over to the new Facebook. The privacy should be something that's built in from the ground floor, not added on later. And also this, what often becomes the really controversial one is this idea of the right to be forgotten. There was a guy in Spain who had bankruptcy, you know, decades later. It would still, if you search for him, did a Google search for him, it would pop up as like the top result that this guy had a bankruptcy. He didn't like it. He sued in the European Court of Human Rights, won, and basically what happened was they said, yeah, and the EU has extended this to everybody, has tried to extend it globally to say, yeah, if you're the search engine, so if you're Google, then you have to remove that. You can't show people that information because it's too old, it's embarrassing, no longer relevant. Doesn't mean that the bankruptcy court that has that information on their website has to change it or take it down, but the search engine, so basically it's a rule designed to make Google take things down that people don't like, and Google has hired hundreds of people to basically manage this process for them. They can afford it, though. Okay, so I'm out of time. Basically, can I have 5 minutes just to finish, and then we'll do the Q&As? Okay, so cyber attack. What is cyber attack? The big question here is, do we need a new set of laws around warfare because of cyber? Do the same laws that apply to how we use everything from an infantryman shooting a rifle to a nuclear weapon to, you know, you name it, any type of traditional military activity or weapon system, can we apply those traditional international rules around warfare to cyberspace, or do we need a new set of rules? So there's a debate that's been going on for years in the UN and elsewhere. You'll be shocked when I tell you that the US and our NATO allies all say the existing rules and laws that relate to combat and warfare are perfectly sufficient for cyberspace. That's our position. China, Russia, and others say absolutely not. Cyber is so different that we have to have a totally new set of rules to deal with it. So that's basically where things stand. And there's been this back and forth fight in the UN for over a decade now to see how to deal with that issue. And let's see. And what Russia and China in particular, particularly Russia, have been pushing for really hard is this idea that there needs to be a UN treaty to deal with cyber issues. And that's cyber warfare, cyber crime, you name it. And so every year they try to push and get support from a small number of countries this idea that the UN should negotiate a cyber treaty, which the US absolutely categorically opposes for all sorts of reasons. As a practical matter, it's never given me that much heartburn, because it would take 10 years just for, so if you had a vote to say, let's have a UN cyber treaty, it would take 10 years just to like get the initial draft done and agree on the terms. It'd be a great, post-employment retirement job for many current officials who work on this stuff. But again, it's this idea that cyber is so different and the US and its allies have such a head start on the rest of the world that there has to be some rebalancing and treatment of cyber issues outside of the way that they have developed, and that current existing laws just don't adequately deal with the issues of cyberspace. So there have been a bunch of bilateral agreements. The U.S. and Russia, the U.S. and China, Russia and China have signed agreements. The agreement between the U.S. and China was China agreeing they would stop stealing our intellectual property. Don't know how well that's worked. With Russia, we basically took a lot of the nuclear controls that we had in place, and we replicated them. So we created a hotline between the Russian president's cyber coordinator and the U.S. National Security Council cyber person so that they could have instantaneous communications. We agreed to use the Nuclear Risk Reduction Center system, which is housed for us at the State Department, to basically allow us to exchange information. The type in, hey, we just saw what looks like a missile launch from Russia. Was that you? Was that on purpose? What should we be doing? We do the same thing for cyber. And we created, so we basically took our pre-existing Cold War ways of dealing with trying to avoid escalation, avoid misperception with the Russians, and replicated them. Internet freedom. Okay, so so Freedom House is an NGO largely funded by the State Department, so by the U.S., by U.S. taxpayers, that assesses press and internet freedom around the globe. They put together a great annual report that ranks countries from most free to least free in terms of internet freedom. And if you look at this chart, you will see right here the most free countries, the lowest barriers to doing things in the internet are Iceland and Estonia, followed closely by Canada and then sort of usual suspects, the United States, United Kingdom, Japan, South Africa, many European countries. You go all the way around here in the least free countries, China, Iran, Ethiopia, et cetera. These are the countries that have the largest numbers of restraints. So you go from, in Iceland or Estonia, which is about a 7 or 8 on a scale of a 1 to 100, and you go up to, China and Iran, which are getting close to 90 on a scale of 100 in terms of the restrictions they place. But they also look at the trends. So red means you're doing worse. So U.S. is red. China is red. Blue, there's a few blues, but not many relative to the reds, means you're doing better. You're getting more free. Okay, Virginia. What is Virginia doing about this? So our prior governor, Terry McAuliffe, really made cyber issues a big priority for his administration. He was also the chair of the National Governors Association for the last year that he was governor. And so he used those two things to really promote cyber at the state level and got the National Governors Association to agree to a set of key things that every state should be tackling in terms of cyber. And so in Virginia, how have we gotten after cybersecurity issues? Well, McAuliffe established a Virginia Cybersecurity Commission in 2014. They met, provided a lot of input and guidance on how to tackle the issues. We drafted a state cybersecurity strategy in 2016. We have a state government portal that you can go to, and it's, you know, all things cyber in the Virginia state government, which is a great source of information. And then lots of different parts of the government have responsibilities for dealing with cybersecurity. I'll highlight second from the bottom there, the Virginia National Guard. So one of the things that we do that the General Assembly funds is as part of our training for our cyber operators. And Virginia is the only state that has both Army and Air National Guard cyber operations organizations, the only state out there. And one of the things we do for training is we go around to local governments. So, you know, we'll go to, Nottoway County or Amherst County, and we'll go to their school system, and we'll do an assessment of their cybersecurity of their networks. The program's run by VITA, which is the Virginia Information Technology Agency. They basically take in the names. They decide, you know, which requests to honor. They hand them to the Virginia National Guard. And then we take the NIST cybersecurity framework that I mentioned earlier, and we go and we use that to do an assessment of local systems. And then we give them a report that's confidential to them. We don't actually fix anything. We don't get on their networks and touch anything. But we at least tell them, hey, your password policy doesn't require anyone to update their password more than once every 5 years. You should probably make it, you know, more often than that. Your passwords are all set to the default password, which is password, and that's not very safe. So that is my whirlwind, tour through all this stuff. And I guess we can ask questions if you're still awake. And
wait for the microphone. We've got a microphone on each side, and there's one over here. So as we're waiting for the microphones to come around, can you generalize on what the motives of China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran are as far as the cyber attacks they're making on our country?
Well, if you look at what the intelligence community global threat assessment, they're all bad. They're all four of them bad in slightly different ways. You know, so the intelligence community says that what Russia focuses on primarily is undermining democratic processes and institutions, trying to break down, you know, cohesion within countries by disrupting their elections, tries to undermine the NATO alliance, tries to undermine democracy in general and create doubt, particularly among the developing world, about whether democracy is such a great thing to have as your political system. They also are very much in focused on using it for military purposes. China, the biggest threat from them is their theft of intellectual property and information from the United States and every other developed country. I mean, we have major issues with China stealing our intellectual property, but so do the Germans, the Japanese, every country that builds things of value, but also then building up their capabilities to use cyber to support their military operations. North Korea, as I said, is essentially, the intelligence community is absolutely right. It's a rogue state that is essentially the most autocratic, repressive country in the world, and also engages in massive criminal activity online. They were traditionally, they and Iran were the biggest creators of currency, and they, now focus, the North Koreans really focus on bank fraud, on stealing money online to fund the regime. And then Iran is, you know, Iran. They're still in the midst of a revolution that, you know, paints us, the Israelis, and, you know, basically every Sunni Muslim country in the Middle East as their enemies. And, you know, they've long been viewed as the largest sponsors of state terrorism. And, you know, they have engaged in all sorts of attacks against U.S. infrastructure, financial infrastructure, back in 2011, 2012, purportedly in response to economic sanctions we put on them. We've indicted several groups of Iranians for hacking into, you know, infrastructure in the United States, controlling water supplies and the like. So Iran is just generally a bad actor in cyberspace, consistent with how it's a bad actor in every other dimension. Yes, sir.
Question, you're in the front.
Two questions here related. One is on this intellectual property theft and how that can be worked into a treaty with China so that there is enforcement and both sides can agree that to make it work. And the second is related in terms of Huawei. Is it possible for them to have a system with their hardware that always has this back door?
Yeah, so the first question is actually super timely. So as part of the World Trade Organization, literally last week, there's a new process that just started up that's looking at how to treat digital economy issues in the context of the World Trade Organization's processes and the like. It also has become a key part of any modern treaty. So, for instance, also when I was at the State Department, I got to work for several years on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty that we were negotiating. Huge, huge protections built into that treaty, the new whatever the replacement is for NAFTA, you know, also beefs up those protections. So increasingly it's being viewed as something, these issues, not just of you know, theft of intellectual property, but also ensuring free flow of information so that for instance, commercial purposes, if you're going to do, you know, business globally to make sure that, you know, certain countries aren't able to enact laws that limit your ability to move data around and the like. So literally right now, the World Trade Organization is just starting this process of trying to figure out how to get its arms around, you know, intellectual property, digital type issues. Looking forward, there are certain protections that are there now. You know, Huawei, again, the U.S. intelligence community assessed and continues to, you know, make the point publicly that Huawei was started by a, you know, retired or former, you know, People's Liberation Army officer, that even though he claims there are no ties with the company, that we don't believe that. You know, it's the same dynamic you see with Kaspersky Labs, which is a big antivirus company that has essentially been banned from business with the U.S. government and the U.S. Its founder, Eugene Kaspersky, is a former FSB KGB agent. You know, I mean, so, you know, would you trust a company like that? So a lot of it just has to do with the connections. What's interesting, I think, to look at right now is how other countries are trying to figure out the Huawei challenge. So, you know, Australia has banned Huawei, but the UK has really been trying to grapple publicly with what to do about, you know, letting Huawei in as part of, say, its fifth generation, you know, network. Or, you know, even in the U.S., there are lots and lots of smaller telecommunication companies and businesses that have Huawei equipment all in their networks because they bought it because it's cheaper than what you're going to get from Cisco or from the European companies that are the primary, you know, leaders in this area. But the U.K., you know, has set up a joint venture with Huawei between, so the U.K. has a cybersecurity agency that's really part of GCHQ, which is their NSA. But they have a center in London where they've created a joint center with Huawei and are, you know, testing Huawei equipment. And, you know, essentially the bottom line is, well, no one, at least publicly, can say that they've seen Huawei equipment used by the Chinese to as a backdoor to get into things, but we can't rule it out. And Huawei, like every other company that makes equipment in this area, You know, their cybersecurity is not perfect. It's got cybersecurity protections, but it's, you know, not what you would say should be the gold standard you'd want, say, on a piece of equipment you'd put on a U.S. military network. But that's true of pretty much everybody's commercial equipment. So it's an evolving issue, and I think it's going to be more interesting to see, what happens between the U.S. and China in terms of our trade negotiations. We backed off on going after some, Chinese telecom companies like ZTE. Whether we reverse course and say, okay, Huawei is all good. If they get shut out of the U.S. markets, they get shut out of European markets, then, you know, that will obviously have a huge economic impact on them. But if they then become the de facto standard in Africa, Asia, elsewhere in the world, then you may have, you know, the situation where literally the hardware is predominantly Chinese in certain parts of the world and predominantly U.S., European, and others.
There's a question here with Bruce, and then I'll come over to Robert. Wait for the microphone. And then hold the microphone close.
I was interested in the dark web, how it got started, and what we're trying to do about it. And what is it?
Yeah, so the dark web is any number of things. Most of what's connected to the internet is not publicly accessible or even publicly discoverable. So, you know, UVA has, you know, tens of thousands of computers connected to the internet. And within various departments, engineering, English, you know, you name it, they've got all sorts of networks within networks within networks. So in one sense, the dark web is anything that you can't find by doing a Google search, because it's, you know, for technical or other reasons, just not indexed, not what you can see. And the vast majority of information systems, computers connected to the internet, would fall into that definition of the dark web. The other more sort of insidious, you know, idea of the dark web is that there is, you know, a sort of portion of the internet in which all sorts of criminal and bad activity happens that is largely closed off from the rest of the internet. So, you know, internet technology does very much allow you to create a web. So if you want to sell drugs, guns, you know, you name it on the internet, and have a marketplace to do that, and there are lots of these marketplaces out there, you can build your infrastructure. A lot of these dark market, criminal markets look very much like any other e-commerce site you would go to. I mean, look very much like an Amazon in terms of, you know, you do your shopping, you can save things on a list, you can, you know, put it in your cart, you can choose your shipping methods, all that kind of stuff. They have, you know, commercials that you can find that will, you know, tout their, they'll have, you know, and very importantly, reviews, you know, so, hey, you know, buy your cocaine from Rich instead of Tom, because Rich's stuff is higher quality, and Tom's is usually, if you weigh it a little bit, you know, less than what you paid for. So customer reviews, all that kind of stuff. You can build and operate those sites, but then, you know, you have to technically and otherwise, you know, set them up in a way that, you know, again, Google can't, you know, Google just constantly scans the internet and tries to identify sites and puts them in its database. And you can do things technically and otherwise to make it so that Google can't see your sites. You know, you close your site down so that the only way you can get into it is by having a secret login. A lot of these sites are hosted through things like, you may have heard of the Tor network, which is the Onion Router, which is a Navy research lab, U.S. government funded way of basically hiding your communications. So you link together a bunch of computers, they all run the software, and as you say, okay, I want to go to virginia.edu, I'm going to do it through the Tor network, then what happens is your request to get the UVA website bounces between among, you know, maybe six or eight other computers. Every time it goes from one computer to the next, all the information about where it came from is stripped out and deleted. So eventually your request gets there and comes back in through this convoluted way. But there are ways that you can hide your traffic, but it's expensive, it's complicated, it's time-consuming. So yeah, those things are hard to get after. The way those kinds of sites get shut down is You know, even with the rise of Bitcoin and various types of digital virtual currencies, you still always, having a bunch of Bitcoins is great, but you can't really spend them most places. And people ultimately want real money. They want to be able to buy, expensive, ski resort or beach, front property. They want to buy their, their expensive cars and the like. So if you have criminal proceeds, eventually you got to get it back into regular money, into U.S. dollars or euros or something like that. I mean, it's just the reality of the way the world works. And so you follow the money and you find out about these things. Also, these things tend to grow. They tend to get, you set up your little secret dark market site, but then, the more and more people start using it, the more they tell friends, in like over Facebook and things like that, that law enforcement monitors, you find out about these things. And then for all the cases I've ever been part of or seen, what happens is the FBI or the Secret Service or our foreign law enforcement counterparts, they identify a couple of the bad actors. They, end up arresting them. They then flip and let law enforcement into the network and basically let them trace everything. So you end up solving it like pretty much any other type of organized crime case, where you have to get humans on the inside that are willing to cooperate and help, and you follow the money. I mean, it's much, much more complicated in many cases if you have to do this with things that are dispersed all over the globe. But you solve those crimes the same way you solve pretty much any other type of traditional crime.
I think we have time for one more question, Bob.
Thanks for your talk. The Freedom House data that you showed us, it jives with what we mostly think. Democracies tend to be much more open, accessible to the internet, so forth and so on, than authoritarian governments. Russia, for example, once its mission is to spread disinformation to essentially destabilize democracies. Facebook, do you think, after all, in the beginning of mass communications, there were government oversight of the telephone system, radio, television, and so forth. Do you think it's time for there at least an attempt to be government oversight of these social media things like Facebook?
So what seems, those are great questions. So what seems to be the trend right now in Congress, again, at a bipartisan level, and particularly informed by the various hearings that have been held over the last year or so that have brought, Google, Facebook, Twitter. And initially, a lot of it was focused on Russian interference in the 2016 elections. It's really been expanding over the last year as more and more things come to light about how Facebook has used data or made data available to other commercial entities. The Congress seems to have really started to pick up a head of steam, focused on this idea of reforming our privacy laws. So if you go back again to this idea that in the United States, we do not have a comprehensive comprehensive law to deal with privacy. Most of what gets enforced in terms of Facebook misusing data is done by the Federal Trade Commission. But they are a fairly small commission. They've got broad authority to investigate and enforce unfair business practices. The Justice Department also does a fair amount of work in this area. But it seems to me that particularly over the last 6 to 9 months, and particularly focused on Facebook, that there is a real growing sense in Congress that it's time to come up with some sort of enhanced, more robust legal protections for privacy that would largely be focused on online companies, but probably also you have all these very shadowy data broker companies that build and maintain profiles on individuals and the like. So I think you're going to see some significant legislative proposals coming out in that area. What that means for how and whether things will be regulated. One of the big fights, I didn't mention network neutrality, but one of the big things that you heard about over the last couple of years, not so much in the last year or so, was this idea of how to classify internet services and whether or not they should be classified as traditional telecommunications, so traditional phone and cell phone companies, which the government heavily regulates through the Federal Communication Commission, or whether or not the Googles, the Facebooks, and the Verizons, and the AT&Ts of the world, when they're providing internet service, should be regulated like telecom companies, or they should be allowed to do their own thing. And a lot of it had to do with, you know, Verizon saying, hey, we'll slow down somebody trying to go to, you know, a site that we don't own or that hasn't paid us a fee. You know, so if you want to get your Netflix, then, you know, if Netflix doesn't pay Verizon, then Verizon's going to make it slower. That issue, I think, is not dead at all at the state level. There's a lot of activity going around related to regulating internet service, and I think you'll continue to see that pushed more and more towards being regulated at some point. So, yeah, great issues, more to follow. We'll see how it all plays out.
I know we have two more questions, but we're running out of time, so let me ask them to be asked. Can you stay a couple extra minutes
to answer
a couple questions? So we'll do that. Thank you very much. It's been very informative, very helpful.